for a walk, you can call 604-822-5355. Use one of our direct line phones located in some of the campus libraries. Use one of the big blue phone booths, or even ask campus security to contact us.
If you see walkers around campus and you'd like them to accompany you, stop and ask.
Hello, I'm Farah Khan. This is Prof Talk. Today on Prof Talk, I talked to Dr. Ira Nadell, a distinguished scholar from the UBC Department of English, who has written numerous biographies of major literary figures and a book about the art of writing biography itself. Professor Nadell is currently writing the first biography of American popular writer and author Leon Uris, who at the second half of the 20th century became a top-selling novelist, best known for his novel Exodus. Leon Uris was often called a great storyteller. He died in 2003. Now, to embark on the project of writing a biography of someone's life, as Ira Nadell explains, is not only a challenging test of scholarly ability, it also carries the task of creating a powerful narrative. And a biographer must also resolve questions that reflect the dual challenge of telling history and telling lives. You are tuned in to Prof Talk. It is a pleasure to have you on the show today. Professor Nadell, you have written several biographies during the course of your career, most notably biographies of Leonard Cohen, Tom Stoppard, Ezra Pound, and most recently David Mamet, and you're currently working on a biography of American novelist Leon Uris. You're also the author of a book about the art of biography, which has been praised as one of the best modern examinations of biography as a literary genre. What brought you to the genre of writing biographies?
Yes, well, that's a great question. I ask myself that question every time I begin someone else's life. But the short answer is narrative. I'm very interested in how people construct their lives in terms of how they live them, but equally, how would I reconstruct their life if I'm writing an account of that particular person? One of the things that I don't like to do is begin at the beginning, because I think it's a very conventional and standard and somewhat boring way to start talking about a person's life. And I'm interested in the history of biography. And in the 19th century, the so-called life and letters approach was the standard way to tell the story. And so you would begin not even with the subject's birth, but go back two generations and talk about the great grandparents and what they did and how they somehow led to the emergence of the particular subject. So I'm more interested in trying to locate a kind of significant event, a signature event in the subject's life that might embody the nature of that particular person's accomplishment. And, of course, most of the people I want to write about are creative people. They could be songwriters or poets or dramatists or novelists. So what prompted them to pursue this kind of creative career? And interestingly as well, what propelled them to continue and spend their entire life? I mean, Leon Uris, my current subject, is the author of 13 novels, and his entire life was spent being an author, which is a difficult thing to do and survive as being an author. So two questions, I guess, really emerge. What's the significant event that shaped the person's life or embodies that life? And secondly, why did they continue?
Now, you have written that recreation of life in words is one of the most beautiful and difficult tasks a literary artist can perform. apart from writing a biography, all of the elements of writing a biography, it's a tremendous task. It carries an enormous weight of responsibility. So that's sort of where I see the difficult side. Responsibility meaning, the accountability, not just to the person you're writing about or writing, of. It's also the family, and that can even carry with generations, right?
I think the question is really ethics. You see, there's an ethics involved in writing biography. And the levels of responsibility are very deep because you have a responsibility to your subject, you have a responsibility to yourself as the biographer, and you have a responsibility to others who are going to pick up that particular book and presumably, they expect to have a fairly accurate and honest account of that subject's life. Now, what happens if you're a biographer and you discover this amazing secret in your subject's life that no one has really known about before? What do you do with that information? That's part of the ethical dilemma. Mm-hmm. Do you consult with others? If you're writing about a living subject, do you present that secret to them? Do you hide it and forget about it? These are some of the real challenges that are involved in terms of the process of biography. I've also been very interested in writing mostly about living subjects. So another issue emerges, the authorized life. Is there such a thing? I don't believe there is an authorized life. I oppose authorized lives because it has the implication of that this is totally approved by. And I don't think you want that as a biographer. I think you need certain freedoms to be able to be critical, to be inquisitive, to ask questions that perhaps haven't been asked before. And if this appears as the authorized life, it sounds as though you were limited in some way. So there is a lot of responsibility. It's not like writing a literary analysis of the poetry of Leonard Cohen. The challenge with a figure like Leonard Cohen, for example, is what am I going to do with all his women? And do I identify them? Do I name them? Yeah. Does he want to talk about them? Oh, I just found another list of seven other women he had relationships with in these letters. Yeah. Or in the midst of my research and talking to one person, they lead me to a bunch of other people. So those are the kinds of challenges. I see them as challenges that I think are fabulous, and that's why I'd like to do it, is to kind of process all of this information.
Now, the role of a biographer is multifaceted. Not only are you writing, or you're writers, you're also in the process of writing biographies, you also become historians, in a sense, journalists, archivists, in some ways anthropologists, sociologists. You're also challenged with the task of working with competing biographies, so biographies that have already been published. And how do you work with so many different areas of specialization? How do you develop those over time? And how do you do all of that without sacrificing your own creativity?
Well, obviously, it's very difficult to do that. And I think the only way you can do it is if you forget about it. And so your job really evolves. I don't approach a biography with a scheme. I don't approach the subject saying, this is how I'm going to treat your life. This is the only thing I'm going to be looking at. The excitement in writing biography is how it evolves. I don't know at the beginning where I'm going to end up. That frequently is determined by the kind of information I discover, the kind of people I meet, the kind of stories that are told to me, the discovery of certain archives. Here's one example. In writing about Tom Stoppard, I was put in contact with his first serious girlfriend when he was about 17 and she was about 17. They were both young journalists in Bristol. The woman is now in her mid-60s, and she agreed to meet with me in Bristol, England. And I went and I had dinner with her, and we got on rather nicely. And she could see that I was serious about what I was doing. I wasn't a gossip columnist. I wasn't going to try to dish the dirt on anybody. And we finished a wonderful dinner, and she was helpful, and she answered questions. And then at dessert, she said, "Now that I know what you're kind of about, you might find this interesting." And she bent over into her purse, and she pulled out about 22 love letters that Tom Stoppard had written to her in 1959 when he moved to London and she remained in Bristol. Now, These were phenomenal letters, not because they suggested or evoked something about their romantic relationship, because he was writing about his experiences in London. I just found a flat. Oh, yeah, Peter O'Toole is going to let me live with him for a while. I don't have any money. I'm trying to look for a job. I'm going to start reviewing plays. All this information, this didn't exist in an archive, all right? It was in her purse. And it wasn't in her purse, it was in her home. And this is the excitement, and this is the wonderful, you know, discoveries that you make in terms of writing a biography. So the book took a slightly different turn because I had information that really no one knew existed before except this woman.
Now, you've made those types of attempts to really bring out a really living side of the person. And you know, with the example of your biography of Leonard Cohen, I know that you visited family, you traveled to places that he had traveled. You really got into that person's shoes in a way. And I mean, that is that what really fascinates you about the experience of writing a biography is all of those elements of a person's life that you're able to, you know, in some way connect to. And I mean, it's one thing when a person is living, but of course, as you said, when someone passes away, it is a whole other type of biography in a way.
Well, yes. I mean, first of all, when you're working on a living subject, I think it's very important. It's a requirement to more or less step into their shoes. That is to say, I knew where Leonard Cohen first lived when he moved to London on his way to Greece before he buys a small house with a little inheritance of $1,200 from his grandmother. And I wanted to see the neighborhood. Obviously, it had changed dramatically, but not dramatically in the intervening years. The streets were still called the same streets. The intersections were the same intersections. The pubs were still the same pubs. And there's something about an environment that's very important to experience. Leon Uris, for example, lived in Aspen, Colorado for 18 years during the height of his career. And he built a very striking home overlooking Aspen and the two valleys that make up Aspen, Colorado. I went to Aspen for about 5 days. I had the very good fortune of meeting his third wife, and she was very welcoming and said, as a matter of fact, the house is changing ownership. I know the general contractor. Let's go up. I'll give you a tour. Now, it was fabulous. There's nothing that can duplicate that. I could look at pictures of the house, of which there are some, but walking through it with her, we said, well, this room was this, and this is where he had the study. Oh, and let me take you to this spot and that spot. It's wonderful. And you're not sure what are you going to take away from it, but there is something that you understand. And so when I write a description of that place, I have some a little bit more knowledge. I wouldn't even call it authenticity, but a little bit more knowledge. Now, something else I do when I have those experiences is I take photographs, I take pictures, because the pictures, amateur as they are very helpful for me in reminding me of space and how that space has influenced, again, the creativity or the living experiences of the subject.
Now, I would like to talk about your current project. So can you tell us who Leon Uris is, and where you are in the stage of, you know, what stage you are at in the writing of his biography, and what you're hoping to capture in his biography?
Leon Uris is a very, very interesting figure. He was one of America's first celebrity authors and popular writers. He emerged in the 1950s at the same time as James Michener, the author of Hawaii, Herman Wouk, the author of The Caine Mutiny, Norman Mailer, the author of Naked and the Dead, Irwin Shaw, Young Lions. And Leon Uris comes on the scene in 1953 with a novel about World War II. And all those writers I just mentioned, their first books were about World War II. Tales of the Pacific by Michener, for example, or Caine Mutiny by Herman Wouk. And Uris's book is called Battle Cry. It's about the Marines and Guadalcanal and Tarawa. He fought there, and he dropped out of high school. He never graduated high school to join the Marines because the war had just, you know, Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941. He joins up in January 1942. And his entire life is defined by the U.S. Marine Corps, which is quite remarkable. He's buried at the Marine Corps Cemetery in Quantico, Virginia. But he publishes this book. It becomes a success. He goes to Hollywood, writes a screenplay, does a few more screenplays, and then is asked maybe he could write something about this new country in the Middle East. People don't know too much about it, called Israel. And he decides to go there. He was a great researcher. The result is he publishes a novel called Exodus, which has sold like 50 million copies around the world, and then was made into a film by Otto Preminger starring Paul Newman. And the story of how he wrote the novel and how the film was made, and then subsequent novels that he wrote, the most probably important called Trinity, which is about Ireland, really defined him as a public figure, as a successful novelist. He made fortunes. He lost fortunes. He lived very high. He lived very low. It's a very interesting story. There is a large archive, and I like to work with archive. What's in the archive? Scrapbooks, letters, drafts of the novels, photographs. Eurus also photographed wherever he went. So there's a big record of the process. And there are contracts, which are very helpful because they tell you how much did he get paid for that and how many books were actually sold. So I'm trying to really frame the life of Leon Uris within the story of American popular literature, because it's the first time in the 50s, 60s, and 70s you begin to get novelists who are interviewed on radio programs and who go on television and who have book signings and who travel all over the country and have people rush up to them and say, would you sign my book, please? Would you, you know, could you possibly do this? So it's really two stories. It's the story, sure, of his career and the uniqueness of that career. But at the same time, it's the story of the emergence of the paperback book, because he was very involved with that development as well. And the paperback books, they were selling 5 million, 8 million. There were advertisements on trucks all over America, you know, for Exodus or Mila 18 or Trinity that I mentioned before. So it's a very interesting story. He's not a very good writer. He's not a very good writer, but boy, he can tell a story. And, you know, you'd sit on the airplane or you'd sit, you know, in the library and you'd finish the book, because he took history. His subjects were always historical, and he created characters that were, to use the cliche, larger than life, and you became involved with the plot. He was good at plot, wasn't so great at character. He also did another thing which is interesting. He took events that we think we know something about, but he went into greater depth and detail about them and really exposed the energy, you might say, of that particular event. The uprising of the Warsaw Ghetto, or the development of Irish independence, the conflicts between the Catholics and the Protestants at the turn of the century in Ireland. He had a great skill at doing it. I mean, he was very skillful, but he's not James Joyce by any means. But so I've tried to tell the story of his career, because I think that's what's really fascinating.
Now, what drew you to wanting to write a biography about his life? And in general, what, when you're choosing a person or a subject, what is the pull for you? Is it a personal sort of fascination, reading, for example, maybe his works, or is it something else that's you know, is there other forces could be, there might be a need for that, right? I'm sure a lot of biographers are asked to write biographies, I could imagine. And so in this current project of yours, how did this come about?
Well, this may surprise you, disbelief, that I don't actually believe these characters, these subjects, deserve the reputation that they have. And so I want to find out, is there any value to his prominence as a popular writer? This was a man who was invited to the White House on several occasions. This was a man who was asked to be a judge at a Miss Universe contest. This was a guy who was proudest of being a certified ski instructor in Aspen, Colorado. But this was also a person who, 1989, went to Russia and was, you know, kind of followed. There was a lot of surveillance. There were worries that crowds would form, and crowds did form, because they wanted to meet Leon Uris, a world-famous author. And the same thing was true with Leonard Cohen. When I started that book, I simply couldn't understand why a man whose voice was as terrible as Leonard Cohen a musician who criticized the press because the press said he knew only five chords when he said, "You're absolutely wrong, I only know four." How could a person like that develop such an international following? And that's why I wrote those books, because I wanted to try and understand, is there any truth to the reputation of these people?
Now, do you set a timeline for yourself when you start a biography, or do you just let it flow? What, 'cause it sounds like it's an adventure.
It's always an adventure.
I can't imagine an adventure really having a timeline.
Well, there is a practical side to me, and I work with publishers, and I have a contract, and there is a timeline, and there's a deadline.
So you're given deadlines to
publish by a certain... Well, the deadlines are negotiated, It depends on the nature of the book and the access to the subject, if it's a living subject. Some are more accessible than others.
Right.
David Mamet's a very difficult individual to hook up with. Oh, we did.
Yeah.
But there wasn't the same kind of access that there was, say, to Tom Stoppard or to Leon. Not Leon Uris, I'm afraid. He died in 2003.
Yes.
But to Leonard Cohen.
Leonard Cohen. Yeah.
So it all varies. And this is part of the adventure, and I like that word. I think it's right. You never know when you start. You never know. Really, how much time will you have with your subject? And I have to say, time with the subject is not that important because you get a very subjective take on their life and their experiences, on the people they worked with, and on the stages of their career. It's much more important, I think, to access the people around the key figure. And with David Mamet, I was extremely fortunate in having good access to actors and directors and to some of his old professors and all sorts of wonderful people who provided me with different perspectives than when I chatted with David Mamet about his career.
And so how long would a biography take in terms of its...
Well, approximately 3 to 4 years, okay? You roughly break it down into, say, a year and a half of research and interviews, and then a year and a half of writing, revising. So it's never strict, but that is a broad guideline, really.
Now, are you alone in this process of going through manuscripts? I can imagine you're probably recording interviews, you know? Is it...
Have a team of experts who follow me?
Or help you?
James Michener did. He had lots of people, and Leon Uris always had a full-time research assistant. Occasionally, I have students who help me with some of the research, but I do all the principal interviewing and sort of archival work, largely because that's always at some other location.
Yeah.
So Leon Uris's materials are in Texas. Mm. David Mamet's are principally in Chicago.
You were recently there in Texas?
I go to something called the Ransom Humanities Research Center at the University of Texas, which is one of the great repositories of writers' archives and others as well. So, yes, I go down there a lot. But I also... go to, you know, Leon Uris died at a place called Shelter Island in New York, which is at the end of Long Island.
Right.
And so, of course, I went there. I was able to meet his last research assistant. She gave me a fabulous tour of his house and the area and talked a lot about him. So that's why you go there. So another word for biography might be going there, because you have to, because you never know what you're going to see and you never know what you're going to turn up.
Now, I don't know this in my research. Has there been a biography written about Leon Uris yet?
No. This is the first. I always try to be the first. It was the first biography of Tom Stoppard, the first of David Mamet. There was one done of Leonard Cohen before I wrote mine, but it was dreadful.
Yeah.
And what's the definition of dreadful? They never really interviewed Leonard Cohen. It was written all from secondary sources, and they got all kinds of facts mixed up, including having several people who were very much alive dead in the book. So, you know, it was pretty terrible.
So when I asked you earlier about competing biographies, that's not necessarily something you need to work with when you're...
Well, I wrote on Ezra Pound, and there are a lot of competing biographies there. But
oh, right.
The Pound biography was a different sort of book because it was sort of an introduction to the life of Ezra Pound, and it was one which didn't really require extensive primary research. It was a book that kind of consolidated new material since the last biography had been done, which was 1988. So I think it's successful. It's a short, I think, 200-page account of Ezra Pound, but it's different in nature than, like, you know, doing the first biography of one of these other figures, which you know, it's a bigger undertaking.
I would just want to ask you one last question about one of the books you've recently published, titled "The Golden Gate Bridge:
History and
Design of an Icon." It's obviously not a biography.
It's a biography of the bridge.
Of a bridge.
Right. Okay. It's an interesting story.
Well, that's interesting.
I'm very interested in writing, and I do different types of writing. The first book I ever published was called Trees in the City, which was co-authored with Cornelia Oberlander, who is a very distinguished Canadian landscape architect from Vancouver. More recently, I've been working with an architect in San Francisco named Donald McDonald, who's Canadian, but his career is in the States. He has become, in the last 20 years, a bridge architect. And specifically, he's a kind of consulting architect to the Golden Gate Bridge, which means that he designed the current toll booths on the bridge, he designed the bike rail, he's in charge of the seismic upgrade, and he's currently leading the design team for something called the suicide prevention barrier. So he has also great talent as an artist, and so we decided we would do a short, small little book on the bridge. And it's sort of like an artist's sketchbook. So he's right. illustrated it, and I've written the text.
Right.
And what's important is it's not so much a history of the bridge, but it's an attempt to try and understand why the bridge is a beautiful object. So there's a lot about Art Deco. There's a lot about Aztec monuments. There's a lot about, if you walked across the bridge, what would you look for? Why is the bridge so singular? Why is the bridge, along with perhaps the Statue of Liberty and the White House, you know, among the top three or four iconic images of the United States? And so that's what the bridge is about, the book is about, and the bridge. And it's been a wonderful project, and we plan to do a couple of more like that.
Yeah, 9 million people visit the Golden Gate Bridge every year. I really like how you said that it could in itself be a type of biography, but about a bridge.
Yes, it is.
And so it is. It was probably in that sense your expertise as a biographer came out.
I think it's more, again, to come back to where we started, narrative. It's how you tell the story and what are you going to emphasize. And I think it's crucial that you always be aware of your audience. Now, I mean, that's a cliche, but it's also correct, mm-hmm. because there are so many ways in which you can approach a subject, whether it's a person's life or an object like a bridge. But you want to do it in a way that's going to capture the reader's imagination. You want to do it in a fashion so that the person keeps turning the pages. And really great writers have figured that out. And I think that's really a talent, and I'm still trying to figure it out. But I have a lot of fun doing it anyway.
Well, that's the most important, right? Well, it has been such a pleasure to have you on the show, and I wish you the best of luck in your biography, and we look forward to reading it.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM. You just heard an interview with Professor Ira Nadell from the UBC Department of English. Next week, I talk to Professor Benjamin Perrin from the Faculty of Law, who discusses his beginnings and what compelled him to dedicate his life to the study and protection of human rights, and how his current research at UBC is the first comprehensive account of Canada's involvement in human trafficking. If you'd like to send us feedback, please email us at proftalk@gmail.com, or for an updated schedule of future shows, you can visit our blog at ubcproftalk.blogspot.com. Podcasts of this show can also be heard anytime on citr.ca. I'm your host, Farha Khan. Thanks for tuning in. Talk to you next week.
CITR 101.9 FM is your home for live UBC sports.
Second down and 18 for the Clan at row 37. We got our streaker.
Here's the streaker.
Davies got back. He's got a throw.
Throw it
now
to
he's
the streaker.
It. And the streaker, I think, got Simon Fraser a first down. And we got security getting after him. He's into the Sam, you call it.
He's into the end zone, and he's breakdancing in the end zone bare naked. He's being chased by security, and he's
oh,
fell down.
Look at
security
there.
Fell down.
Go.
Security is
gone.
Go.
He's gone. For
get
the
up
Henry.
The fence.
Oh, he's
going. Go. You gotta love college football.
Did I mention it is also unedited and commercial-free?
He's gonna put his team shorthanded.
As smart as your mom was when she decided not to take birth control.
Well, there you have it.
All the information about our sports department can be found on our website, citr.ca.
Sad.
Look at what's happened to me. I can't believe it myself. Suddenly I'm up on top.
Believe it or not, we're talking about sports.
I never thought I could be.